Hello and welcome to another weekly edition of Popcorn Optional, a weekly movie podcast where we talk all things movies. My name is Cameron Salina, and tonight I am joined by my co-host, Jake Brown.
What's up?
Trevor could not be with us tonight because he just had a baby. So, if you're listening to this and want to congratulate him, you can find him on Twitter at TurboTrevor, and I'm sure that he would enjoy that. Everybody's healthy, everybody's doing good, and congratulations to them.
And she's adorable. And, I mean, it's a pretty good excuse to miss the podcast, I guess.
Yes. If there was ever a good excuse to miss, which we normally shun each other for a whole week if we miss, this is the only acceptable excuse. Like, vacation, shun. You're sick and vomiting out of both ends, shun.
Reshunned.
So Trevor won't be shunned, but... Yes, wish him congrats. Tonight we're going to be doing a review of Guillermo del Toro's new film, The Shape of Water. Guillermo del Toro is the only director to ever end up on the pending list for honorable mentions. We were waiting to see this film and then decide from there, and so we'll get to that at the end of our review. We also are going to take a look back at 2017 in movies, and at the end we're going to do a content of the week. But let's go ahead and get into our look back at 2017. And 2017 was a pretty, I feel like it was a pretty fantastic year for movies. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, granted, we started doing this podcast, and so I've been seeing a lot more movies than I had in the past, especially in the theaters. But there were a few movies this year that really blew me away. And it was a lot of fun this year to be a moviegoer. Unfortunately, ticket sales don't reflect that, but it was a pretty good year at the cinema.
Ticket sales in 2017 were the lowest they've been since 1992, so for 25 years. This year, there were 1.239 billion tickets sold, which the average over the past 25 years has been 1.422. So almost 200 million less tickets sold, which is just insane. And if you even want to take it as far as last year, there are almost 100 million more tickets sold. So I think we can all, being you and me on this podcast tonight, agree that probably the strongest reason for that necessarily isn't weak box office or weak films to see in movie theaters, but the rise of Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and VOD and the ability to watch movies at home.
Yeah, there's just too much good stuff out right now, which is like the worst thing you can complain about is like, oh, there's too much good TV on.
Right.
And also, I mean, ticket prices just keep getting more expensive. You know, that's one of the reasons that I champion MoviePass so much, and that's why we're such big fans of it. We use it every week, and it's incredible. But yeah, I mean, when Netflix is putting out pretty good to really good, consistently original material, and you have Hulu and Amazon doing the exact same thing, and then you have the iTunes, Apple Movie Store. Like, people are staying home, and I can't really blame them.
Yeah, interestingly enough, in the month of December, MoviePass added 500,000 subscribers, just in that month alone. They're at 1.5 million. So that's a pretty strong base for them to go from there. And MoviePass is one of those things where, you know, it's $9.95 a month, or if you're willing to pay for a whole year upfront, it'll equate out to $7 a month. So if you pay $96, is that the right math? That's the wrong math. $86 upfront, you get a whole year of free movies, free 2D movies, not IMAX, Cinemark XD, 3D, nothing like that. And that's pretty amazing. And I think the hard thing then when it comes to that is that the reason, at least my biggest reason, if I was ever to compare at-home viewing versus theater viewing, is there are movies that deserve to be seen on the big screen. And I think some of those that we saw this year were films like Dunkirk and Blade Runner 2049. And unfortunately, those are films that I want to see in IMAX, which isn't covered by MoviePass.
Yeah, I think I shelled out the extra cash to see Blade Runner in IMAX, and it was worth it.
Oh, 100%.
But yeah, I mean, unfortunately, though, most films that come out aren't made in that frame of mind with the director. Right. You know, very few directors and films can afford big screen blockbuster budgets. Right. And then also, like, the gap time between film in the theater to on streaming has gotten so short now that it's really easy to just say, you know what, I'm just going to wait until it comes out and we'll rent it at home.
Yeah, that's good for a lot of movies. There are movies like, I'm trying to think of movies that I watched at home and then I watched in theaters. Like a movie like The Big Sick, which I watched in the theater and is in a fantastic romantic comedy and true story and deserves to be seen by everybody. But that's a movie that is now on Amazon Prime and you can watch for free if you're an Amazon Prime subscriber. And I don't really feel like anything was lost in the viewing between a screen and, or a movie theater screen and watching it at home. That's a sad thing to say because I love so much the environment of just being in a movie theater. But for a lot of people, it's just troublesome to get out to the movies. And I think the biggest thing is something that me and Jake experienced when we went to go see The Shape of Water is just poor crowds. I mean, we had people talking next to us the entire movie. And luckily Jake is a person that isn't scared of anything and just, you know, will shush people. No shame, which is a great thing. I, on the other side, am too scared and, you know, nothing would happen. I was just like, oh, I don't want to say no. Or
granted, it was two old women, so I feel like we could have taken them. But
yeah. I think in a fight, which I don't ever want to go to violence, so let's say it's a verbal argument, I feel like our wits would have stood the test.
I hope.
But you never know. They have experience over us. We are just two youthful young men with a podcast that
stupid whippersnappers.
Exactly. Exactly. But 2017 was a great year. The three highest grossing films all had female leads. Star Wars, The Last Jedi, Beauty and the Beast, and Wonder Woman domestically. For the first time ever, there were three black directors that had films gross over $100 million. Girls Trip and director Malcolm D. Lee, Fate of the Furious and director F. Gary Gray, and Get Out from Jordan Peele. Not to mention that Jordan Peele made his directorial debut with Get Out. Greta Gerwig made her solo directorial debut with Lady Bird. And Aaron Sorkin, one of the best writers in Hollywood, made his directorial debut with Molly's Game. I think that there's, even outside of, you know, those three little categories, there's a lot that 2017 had brought to the table movie-wise that's exciting and that should be looked upon and awarded by audiences. And I wish more people had showed up to the movies, because when I looked back at, you know, this is Shape of Water is our 35th review of our podcast so far, most of which are films that came out this year. And, you know, that's one of those things where I look back at that list and go, the majority of the movies we saw were pretty good films, you know, BA films. And not a lot of F's. I mean, there were some F's, you know, there are catastrophic things like Pirates of the Caribbean, King Arthur, Transformers. But overall, it was a great year at the movies. And we're going to do another review next week, most likely of I, Tonya. And then the weekend after that, we'll go ahead and do our 2017 top 10, where we will break down each of our top 10 films of the past year. And that'll be fun to go through, and that'll be good. But I wanted to get this out of the way now, not get it out of the way, talk about it now, so that we could just focus on our top 10 and not extend the time of that episode past 4 hours, as it possibly could be.
It might.
But one of the things that's most interesting is there were a bunch of superhero films that came out this year. Logan, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Wonder Woman, Spider-Man Homecoming, Justice League, Thor Ragnarok, and a lot of them were good. I would say in that list, all except for one, Justice League, were good films. But what was your favorite superhero movie that came out this past year?
Yeah, I'm going to go first and second place. because I liked both of these a lot, but for totally different reasons. My favorite was Logan. I was very surprised by this film. Absolutely loved it. It's totally different than anything else we've gotten in the superhero genre. Hugh Jackman kills it in his final take on the role. Just fantastic. And then second is Wonder Woman, which I'm sure we'll probably talk about later. But if not, and if you haven't seen it, how have you not seen it? It's fantastic. Just go see it. It's amazing. Gal Gadot's a treasure. Patty Jenkins does an amazing job. It's perfect.
And if I'm actually not mistaken, to add to our list of feats from 2017, I'm pretty sure that Patty Jenkins is one of the first female directors to have a film gross over $100 million on its opening weekend.
I think she was the first.
She was the first. Okay, good. I thought so, and I couldn't remember exactly. So good for her. My number one film, or my number one superhero film, not my number one film, my number one superhero film was Spider-Man Homecoming. This is a character that I grew up reading in comic books, watching on animated TV, and the Tobey Maguire movies were fine, but it never felt like the Spider-Man that I grew up loving. Andrew Garfield
also
did a great...
After Molly's Game, I just can't look at Tobey Maguire. I can't
yes,
do it.
Exactly. That's another big thing. Or after The Disaster Artist, all I want to do is watch James Franco. So true. It's kind of a contradiction there. But Spider-Man Homecoming, and Andrew Garfield did a great job, but his movies were poor. This is the first time that I walked out of a Spider-Man movie like, that's the Spider-Man that I've always wanted to see on the big screen. He's a high school kid. He's nerdy, but he has this kind of like cocky flair to him, and he messes up, but he's a kid, so you're rooting for him, and it captured so many of the emotions that I want in a Spider-Man film. And job well done to Marvel. That film shocked me, because I remember even saying back in June, a couple weeks before the movie came out, like, I'm a little worried about this one. They've given so much away in the trailers, and not to mention that movie had maybe the best villain of the year in a movie, in Michael Keaton's Adrian Toomes, aka Vulture.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. What film shocked you the most this past year?
I also have two on this one. Get Out is the first one, because it just like literally came out of nowhere and just kind of blew the whole country away, because everybody saw it, it seems like. And it was directorial debut. It came out in like January or February or something. And so
I think it was
like
very early February.
Yeah. Everyone was like, whoa, whoa, what is this? But yeah, I mean, it's just fantastic. And then also Star Wars The Last Jedi, just the way they took the series, was not expecting that at all. But I'm on board, and I loved it, and I don't really get the hate for it. So yeah, Last Jedi.
Yeah, check Last Jedi is also, I had two as well. Last Jedi is one of mine. This is ultimately a place where I love having a podcast, but having to see a movie, getting to see a movie every week has disrupted the amount of times I've gotten to see Star Wars. I've only seen it once. Normally, if there's a Star Wars movie in theaters, I've seen it like five times by now.
Yeah.
And I'm bummed I've only seen this movie once, but I love doing this podcast and getting to see tons of new movies. So it balances out. But this movie, like Jake said, just shocked me from a standpoint of what was in the movie. It blew me. Like, I remember my jaw being on the floor multiple times. And that's an experience that I haven't had in a movie theater in a long time, is, you know, in this society where we are spoiler culture and everything wants to, you want to know everything about a movie before going in, and half the times trailers give you that information. This is a movie that gave you very little information, and what it did give you was misdirection, and then in the end ultimately gave you this shocking masterpiece of a film. My other film that I was the most shocked by was It. And I'm shocked by this because if you're a longtime listener of this podcast, long time being since May of this past year, you know that I'm not a huge fan of horror films. And I ultimately walked away from It blown away by what I had just seen, because it was a horror film that I loved. And I haven't had that happen. I know that Get Out is technically a horror film in a lot of ways, but I mean like a straight up horror, no holds barred film. And it was that for me. It was it blew me away in how much I liked being scared. That was the first time I've ever had an experience like that in a theater. So I'm excited for It Chapter 2.
Yeah.
Lastly, what was the film that disappointed you the most this past year?
Once again, I have two because I can't make choices. The first one is, we actually just talked about it. It's a Molly's Game. Ooh. I was really expecting excellence from this film, just with the cast and the like, a loose understanding of the story and the fact that it's Aaron Sorkin. And honestly, it was just fine. And unfortunately, Aaron Sorkin has set the bar very high for himself with his career. And I was disappointed. And then also, It Comes at Night. I was so excited for this movie based on the trailers. And seeing it in the theater, it wasn't a bad movie. It just was not at all what I was expecting. And so I was disappointed. And I blame the studio and the marketing for deciding to market it in that vein. That really misled the viewer and really upset my viewing experience. So, yeah, those two films.
Ooh, I didn't even think about It Comes at Night. But my two most disappointing films are Logan Lucky and Justice League. Logan Lucky is Steven Soderbergh's return to the big screen. And, you know, it was a fine film, but it was a very forgettable film.
Yeah, I haven't thought about it at all since we saw it.
Yeah, it came out back in August. And as I was going through my top 10 of the past year, I remembered that film and I was like, oh my gosh, that came out this year. That feels like that doesn't stand out in my head at all in this year of amazing films that, you know, it's kind of disappointing that, you know, Soderbergh's big return to the screen was not as good as his past films. Yeah. And the other one being Justice League. I had so much hope for this movie. I was so hopeful with Joss Whedon coming on and them just having Wonder Woman as a success. And, you know, for as much crap as Zack Snyder gets, he's a fantastic visual director. I don't think anybody's ever argued that he wasn't good at visually directing films. And this was a film that ultimately just let me down.
Didn't even look good.
Yeah, it just, there was no like story really. It was just like this this bad guy comes in, wants to take over, has a bunch of henchmen, and we try and stop him. And oh yeah, along the way, spoiler, if you haven't seen Justice League, Superman comes back, but doesn't, just kind of.
It was bad.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I had zero expectations for it, so.
Well, there you go. Fortunately, Jake was on the good side of that bad film. That's all we have, though, to talk about look back at 2017. If you have films that you were shocked by or disappointed by, tweet us at Popcorn Optional. We would love to hear your thoughts and talk to you about why those films were shocking or disappointing to you. Or if you disagree with us that Spider-Man or Logan or Wonder Woman were some of the best superhero films of the year, tell us why. We'd love to hear it.
Well, one last thought on 2017. One thing that makes me really excited to be in, as small as I am in the filmmaking industry, one thing that's really excited to be in it right now is, in the past like 10 years, filmmaking has kind of gone through like three game-changing phases, and we're in the third one right now. About like 10 years ago, we had the democratization of technology. DSLR filmmaking hit the world and everybody could pick up a camera and start shooting, air quotes, cinematic footage. And by cinematic, I mean it has shallow depth of field. Oh my gosh. But that, like,
full frame.
That was most people's introduction, and that was fantastic. And then I would say 5-ish years ago, we had the democratization of distribution and like YouTube and Vimeo and Those became very serious distribution platforms where you can make a short film, put it directly online, and actually make money and a career from it. It's hard, but you can do it. And you started to see the rise of YouTubers and vloggers and these video essay people that never would have been able to make a living doing what they're doing now, which is incredible. And I think now we're starting to see the democratization of power with the Me Too movement, and we're starting to see female directors and minority directors get big budgets, big stories. We're having power taken out of the hands of the
pigs.
Yeah, pigs, just jerks. Words that I can't comfortably say on this podcast. But
while trying to keep it family friendly.
Right. And you just have really unique voices coming up in Hollywood right now that are getting the attention they deserve. And it's really exciting. And so I'm really pumped for like the next 5 years to see what this phase of filmmaking is going to bring to the world.
Yeah. Wow. Incredibly well put. And yeah, that's definitely an exciting thing to think about, the new voices that we're going to be getting in movies that we haven't had before, whether it's from smaller indie films that and people that now have access to technology, or directors, female directors, minority directors that now are going to have the opportunity to present their story and tell their story that we haven't been able to hear before. So that's, yeah, incredibly well said, Jake.
Thanks.
I think we should just end the podcast there. I think that's a high note. And, we now get to talk about The Shape of Water.
Yeah.
And I'm a little bit nervous.
So we have to talk about it now.
Yeah, we saw a movie, so, you know, we get to talk about it. I'm a little nervous to talk about this, and we'll get into that in just a second. But, yeah, it's The Shape of Water just won Best Picture at the 2018 Critics Awards. It's also won Best Director, Best Production Design, and Best Score. And then one of the interesting things was there's a theater by where I live, and this is where Jake and I went to go see the movie. And it's the Cinemark Tinseltown, Cinemark Grapevine Tinseltown, Cinemark Tinseltown, some version of those three words. And it was the closest theater to me that was playing Shape of Water. And it's not normally a crowded theater. I mean, the tickets are normally cheap, and so sometimes, depending on the movies, it'll bring people. But I did not expect for The Shape of Water to be crowded whatsoever. I showed up 5 minutes early to almost a fully packed theater and was blown away at how many people were there. And so, you know, I think I haven't seen a ton of advertisement for it on TV, and so my thought is, you know, a lot of people are going to see this because of the Golden Globes win from Guillermo del Toro winning Best Director.
Yeah,
and
just the press that it's been getting these past couple weeks has been pretty crazy.
Yeah. And I in particular have knocked on awards not meaning anything for quite a bit the past couple weeks, and you know, I've changed my mind on that slightly, and I think that the power of the awards is to bring people to go see films that they normally wouldn't get to go see, and being able to highlight films that are smaller that deserve to be seen on the big screen. And so for that, I'm happy that Shape of Water won Best Director. Now we can get into general thoughts on whether or not I think that that award is warranted or not. So Jake, before I make an idiot of myself, why don't you go ahead and talk about your general thoughts for this movie?
Okay. So I like Guillermo del Toro. Pan's Labyrinth, I think, is one of the best films of this century. One of the best foreign films that has penetrated the American pop culture zeitgeist. Pacific Rim is one of the best blockbuster popcorn films that I've ever seen in the theater. It's a ton of fun. His other films are okay to good at best. They often have these like glimpses of greatness, but for some reason they haven't really fully worked for me. and now we arrive at Shape of Water. First off, this film is a technical masterpiece. It was also apparently only a budget of $20 million, which blows my mind.
Yeah.
$20 million. That's for how good this looks, that's insane. Whoever was the producer and like line producer for this, doing all the budgeting and everything, well done. The cinematography, the production design, the art direction, the period pieceness of it for like how well it is done with the art direction and production design, incredible. The score is top notch. And it's deserving of all of that praise that it is receiving. But once again, this movie just doesn't quite pull it together for me. And I don't understand the award praise that it's receiving. Like, it's a beautiful film. It's fine, but is this really the best picture of the year? Is this really the best directing of the year? If so, I strongly disagree, and I feel like there have been much better directed, much better films this year that tackle a lot of the same things this is tackling in terms of like commentary on society. So I enjoyed it. It's fine. I have a lot of issues with it that we can talk about here in a little bit, but I don't get it, man. I don't understand the praise this is getting.
I am very glad that you said that, because I was fully ready to go on tonight's podcast and make an idiot of myself saying that I did not think that this film was an overall masterpiece, as many have been calling it.
And well, what's funny is we saw this together, and
which happens very rarely.
When you do a podcast with somebody reviewing a movie and you happen to see a movie together, you basically just have to like walk away and just be like, okay, I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye.
Which is odd when you're actually friends with somebody and want to be like, let's hang out.
Yeah. We were just like looking at each other and I was trying to read your face and you had this like uncomfortable smirk on your face. And I was like, I think we have the same opinion, but I just got to go, 'cause we can't start talking about it.
Yeah. And that's unfortunate, because sometimes, you know, the best conversations about movies are had right after them. But I feel like this movie giving us a chance to breathe on it confirmed my opinion. There are films that I've seen this year that at first glance, I was like, that was good, not great. And ultimately, as I've thought about them more, have been more and more effective and powerful, one of which being Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. When I first saw that film, I was like, you know, that was good. I enjoyed that, but it wasn't, you know, the masterpiece that I had come to expect from what I had been hearing. But now that I've had time to think about it, I think it's been about a month now since I've seen it. It's even more powerful, and it's probably going to be in my top 10 in somewhere, and it's incredibly well done. But this film, I went into it, and I'm somebody who, I love Del Toro, because no matter what, whether or not the movie ends up being good overall or not, you're always going to get some form of a visual treat. His films are always fun to watch, and I am probably on the side of liking more Del Toro films than not. I think, like Jake said, Pan's Labyrinth is a masterpiece that doesn't get talked about enough. And if whenever, you know, 83 years from now, they do the best films of the past 100 years, I'd be shocked if that's not one of the tops, because it's just beginning to end a unique breath of fresh air that we don't get often enough. And that was ultimately what I was expecting from this, was a unique, brand new story. And ultimately, I don't feel like we get that. There's nothing. There's technical things that are done very well, but most times when you walk out of a Del Toro film, you go, that's something I've never seen before. And I feel like everything that's in this movie is something that we've seen before. And like Jake said, it's something that we've seen done better even this year. You know, maybe the love story between a human and a monster, in Del Toro's words, monster. Maybe, you know, that's unique and I get what Del Toro was trying to set out. I've listened to interviews with him where, you know, he said, I always grew up, you know, Del Toro loves monsters. And I think that's apparent if you look at his past films being, you know, Pacific Rim, Hellboy, Pan's Labyrinth, Blade. I mean, he loves monsters. He loves creatures and he's very good at working with them. But I feel like, you know, when he set out and wanted to make a film where the monster got the girl and ended up with the girl, I was hoping for something that was a little bit more unique. And
yeah,
I, you know, my, what I go to movies for is the stories. And I think there are films that are artistically great, but have no, don't have much depth as far as story goes and don't have much uniqueness or creativity as far as stories go. And I feel like that's ultimately where I landed on this movie was, you know, the character, the characters didn't really feel like they moved that much from beginning to end. There wasn't that much. I think that there is some depth to the plot, but I feel like there's more depth to the symbolism of certain colors and how he uses that. And that's great, but I feel like I've been rambling for a while. There are parts of this movie that are great, and there are parts of this movie that I was just like, okay, okay. I mean, did you think it was predictable? It felt very predictable.
Yeah, and it was
not
so
that there's
predictable.
Anything wrong with that.
No, I mean, it was so predictable that the little old ladies next to us were telling each other what was about to happen. And
yes,
that was super annoying. But yeah, I mean, there's nothing inherently unique about this. I will say it is a love letter to classic cinema. I can understand the predictability of the story. It's your typical plot, you know, and that's fine. This should have been the beginning of Universal's Dark Universe. If you're gonna do it, like, this should be the beginning, duh. This is definitely Guillermo's best looking film. I forget who the cinematographer on it was, but apparently they planned to shoot it in black and white originally.
Hmm.
And I'm so glad they didn't, because like you said, Cameron, the color stuff was fantastic in this. And it just looks so good. So I really commend them for the visual aesthetic of this film. And in that vein, I can see where people are saying this is the best directed film, from a technical perspective. Also, the performances from this, Sally Hawkins and Richard Jenkins, I think are fantastic. I also think that they have probably the best scene of the year that I've seen so far. They share a moment that was very powerful for me and worked really well.
Which, without trying to give too much away, which scene was that? I'm curious.
It was the scene where, we're going to get into spoilers. So, spoilers.
So let's go ahead and get into spoilers. If you haven't seen The Shape of Water yet, it's out in theaters now. It's in somewhat wide release. It's not playing in a bunch of places, but I'd be willing to bet that if you are somewhat close to a theater, a couple of theaters, that's probably playing at one of them. So if our mediocre analysis of it has you interested in trying to figure out what we've been talking about, please go see it and then come back and listen to the rest of this podcast.
This movie is worth seeing. It's worth seeing in the theater.
Yeah. So we are going to get into spoilers for The Shape of Water. Go ahead, Jake.
So the scene where she's trying to get, I think Giles was his name?
Giles, yes. Richard Jenkins' character?
Yes.
Yes, Giles.
Get him to help her save the creature. And she's signing everything because she's mute. And she says, sign what I say. And the physicality of the performance she gives and his like emotional slowness of reading it, like his coming to the realization of it and just the presence she has in that moment, because she's so small and meek. And this film does a lot with like the power of communication and giving voice to the voiceless. And that was just a really great, great scene. And I thought it was really powerful.
Yeah. I agree with you that it's a powerful moment. I'm trying to figure out how to put this because I think Sally Hawkins and Richard Jenkins both do great jobs and are both fantastic in these roles, deserve to get all the credit for these roles. But ultimately it was one of those things where there had been nothing up until that point that added weight to that scene that I would hope for. Like even in Molly's Game, a film that, you know, we gave mediocre reviews to, and there's that scene on the bench with Kevin Costner and Jessica Chastain that's so moving, even though, you know, not a lot was done with Kevin Costner's character up until then. And, you know, there's that, like, I'm a sucker for really good, heartfelt lines. And there's that line that she signs that he's like, where Richard Jenkins says, you know, he's not even human, and then kind of walks away, and she pounds on the wall to get his attention and then signs, if we don't help him, we're not either. I think mm-hmm. that's a very powerful sign and is delivered at the perfect moment. But outside of like that line, the rest of it was kind of like, I hate to say this, 'cause I think you're right in a lot of ways. It's a very powerful scene, but in a lot of ways it's like, I feel like such a downer for saying this, but it didn't need to be done the way that it was done. Like, say what I'm signing. Like, the connotation there to me was almost as if he's not, like, he's interpreting it like however he wanted to, instead of like actually.
That's the whole point, though.
I know. Yeah, that's
the whole.
As I'm talking about,
that's
it.
That's like the that scene is the movie.
Yes.
Because the entire, like, so I think that this film does a good job of tackling some really tough, like, themes in a way that it sometimes is a little too heavy-handed about. But giving voice to the voiceless, the power of communication, man's dominance over women, we get that with Michael Shannon's character and how he wants just silence and wants to be in control. And even when,
I mean, not even over just women, over everything, his dominance
right.
is over,
but
his
especially,
car, his house, everything,
especially over women. We see it with
yes.
his secretary, his wife, the help. We have class warfare in this with, the quote, the help versus generals, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Richard Jenkins and Sally Hawkins scene basically sums up the film. Because it's so funny, me and my wife will do this all the time. Well, we'll get in an argument, and I'm such like a big picture person. And then I'll be like, well, you said this. And she's like, I did not say that. You're saying back what you think I said to you. And I'm just like, yeah, you're right. I do that all the time. I just, in my own mind, I twist it because I'm so important in my head. And so I think that scene does a really good job of addressing, like, no, listen to me. What am I actually saying?
Yes. And that's incredible. I get the message of the movie is, you know, the voice of the voiceless. And in that scene, that's very well done. It comes off as heavy-handed in that she's like, say exactly what I'm saying. And hear me exactly. It just felt, for a Del Toro film that's normally like a big, grandeur, colorful film, that's one of my favorite things about Del Toro is he's very like in your face while also being very subtle. And I felt like this film lacked a lot of that subtlety that he normally, like, it had the like in your face with color and all these other things, but it lacked that like depth and subtlety that I normally love in a Del Toro film.
I agree.
And
I think it's lacking subtlety in other areas, like in the diner with Richard Jenkins finally like telling the pie guy that he likes him. And then
yes.
you have the awkward moment of like, oh, wait, no, this guy is like typical 1950s macho man, like, get out of here, blah, blah, blah. But then you, on top of that, we now have the African-American people walking in, and he's like, no, get out of here. I was like, okay, we got it. Like,
we get it. He's not a good guy as he comes off.
Yeah.
But that, what's interesting in that scene is, so for so much of the movie, Richard Jenkins goes to this place because he has a crush on the guy that owns the pie shop, and he orders key lime pie, even though it's terrible. And he, I feel like is Del Toro's best piece of this film, and his use of the color green, and its use of green being a color of lying and untrustedness, if that's a word. That's not great on my part, but hang with me for just a sec. So for most of the film, Richard Jenkins' character, Giles, orders pie from this place, even though he hates the pie. It's terrible. He even says it, and at one point goes to put him and Sally Hawkins' pie up in the fridge, only to reveal that there are 15 other pies in the fridge that are half eaten because they're all terrible pies. And it's this key lime pie that, you know, gives that color. And, you know, when he goes to sit down and have that scene, the guy goes, we're all out of key lime pie like you normally like, but we do have strawberry. And I feel like strawberry in the color red is often used in this film in a very, like, this is the truth, the real, the blood of the blood. This is the truth that you're seeing. And, you know, at the end of the film, when Dr. Robert Hofstadter, aka Dimitri, Michael Stuhlbarg's character, is shot, he's shot in the face, and that's the moment that you know, Michael Shannon sees who he really is, and you see that the blood, in the red, revealing who he really is. And I mean, if you even want to go to it, Michael Shannon finally shows the whole movie, the audience is aware of this, like, evilness within him and this dark side of this control, but it's never really shown to everybody. And at the end, when he's at Octavia Spencer's place and he gruesomely breaks his fingers at the amphibian man played by Doug Jones had bitten off earlier in the movie and then were reattached, he reveals his true character in that moment. And so I think that's one of Del Toro's best parts of this movie, is his use of the color. I mean, even down to Colonel Richard Strickland, Michael Shannon's character, he buys the car, and it's, oh, I love this green car. And he's, actually, it's teal. And then he shows up to the place. It's green. Actually, it's teal. And it's another lie. It's another lie. It's another untrusted thing. He even has green candy. Giles even does a red, truthful, the beautiful art of the Jell-O. And then the advertising company goes, actually, green's the color of the future.
That's cool. I took green to mean something different, a little different, but
okay,
yeah, well, that all totally makes sense.
What did you take green
for
to mean?
For me, I took it as like the contrast of man and nature, because like green is the classic color associated with nature for obvious reasons. And then you have water, which is blue for obvious reasons. And if you combine them, you get teal. And so the creature and a lot of other things are teal or green. Like, and so I saw it as kind of being used in an ironic way, of like green is the quote, the future, or like what we decided the future was going to be in the 1950s and how fake it all is. Like Jell-O is fake. The candies are fake. Like the key lime pie is gross and fake. So kind of like you said, of like a lie, but also kind of like nature versus what we've repurposed the color green for, which is all this like incredibly fake stuff.
Greed.
Yes.
And I feel like we're saying the same thing, because I think that Del Toro is trying to say that the future and everything in it is a lie.
Yeah.
And
like when the kid asks Michael Shannon, are we going to have jetpacks, Dad? And he's like, this is America, son. Of course we're going to have jetpacks.
Right, exactly. And that's, you know, he's trying to say that, you know, in the future, everybody and everything will become so fake and artificial. And, you know, and in this movie, it's a time when everything is real and tangible and at your fingertips, not in the way that it's at your fingertips now, but in an actual physical sense at your fingertips, not on your fingertips in a phone. And I feel like that's very well done. And that's a part of the film that I loved. And I thought was a very effective, piece, but that's outside of that and the production design, job well done on those parts. And I, it's hard for me to bash a film because ultimately I love Guillermo del Toro. I think he's a very talented director. He's a director that I will give, if I was a studio exec, I would give $100 million to make a movie every year, because even if he fails one year, he's going to have a massive hit the next. I mean, he's just, his stuff's just so inventive. And so I don't want to focus on the negative, but it's a movie that ultimately just didn't work for me in a lot of ways.
So let's get to why it didn't work, because I have some major complaints that basically break the movie for me.
Okay.
So my first big one, I have like three or four, but mainly 3 points. The first one, and feel free to hop in at any time.
Okay.
The structure of the film doesn't work for me. Like the first half of the film, the first hour, I was like super into it. But I feel like the second act of the film doesn't set up the third act in a way that is satisfying. Like we spend just two scenes essentially with Eliza and the monster before she's fallen in love with him. Like, right. I really liked seeing them in the lab interact, but we get like 3 minutes of that.
So where does the third act start for you then? Like, of where does it kind of fall after they break him out of the facility?
I think it is. It's kind of in between, like after the breakout. I think it actually might be like once the relationship takes a sexual turn, because that's essentially like there's no going back. Which is my second major complaint. We go from Eliza and the monster being sweet and like teaching each other sign language to them having sex really quick. Like,
yes,
it super weirded me out. And I know that this film is using the relationship between them as like a commentary on society. And I think it's a strong commentary, and you know, we can talk more about that, but like, this is basically bestiality and it doesn't earn it. And then can you ever earn bestiality in a film? Like, it's weird.
I'm with you. Like, that was a weird part that for a romantic movie, I didn't buy the romance.
Yeah.
And I was trying to think of why I didn't buy that. And I think you hit it, Jake, when you said that it didn't feel deserved or worked for. Like, we don't get to that place where that's what we would expect. There's never time of like them developing
so quickly.
Yeah. And there's never scenes of them developing. Like, there's like two scenes and it's like her bringing him eggs. And then before you know it, she's playing records for him. And it's just, I think it'd be a stronger film if that full on like romantic side wasn't in there. And it was more of like two people caring for each other. I think that would be more effective of like, just care. Like, cause I think ultimately what it's trying to say is like, just because you're an outsider and just because you are voiceless and marginalized doesn't mean that your voice counts any less. Doesn't mean that you should be cared for or loved for any less. And I think that's a very powerful message, but it just didn't work in the context of this film because of where the romantic relationship came out of. It didn't feel worked for.
Yeah. Like, I totally was with the film and their relationship when it was this like innocent getting to know other worlds combining, you know, and it was almost like a Tarzan and Jane kind of thing. But if Tarzan was a fish, I guess that doesn't work.
I mean, you could even go back to earlier this year and go to, it's kind of a Beauty and the Beast type of thing.
It is. Yeah. But the fish isn't really a guy. I don't know. It just, I was like with it. And then the moment she got in the shower, I was like, nope, 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 nope. Don't like it. So yeah.
Yeah. Okay, do you have any other parts with this movie?
One big other complaint that kind of broke it for me is just like the logistics of the lab. Like, I'm willing to suspend disbelief when I see a film, but you're telling me that a cleaning lady has unlimited and unsupervised access to the most sensitive, quote, the most sensitive asset in the history of this top secret military lab. You're telling me that there is an unlocked door with a hallway out of this top assets lab that goes all the way down to the loading docks. Like, just stuff like that where I'm like, guys.
Or not to mention the fact that there wasn't, especially with all the Cold War suspicions going on at that time and even played up in the movie, that there wasn't a constant security guard at the door or inside
just
or something.
Like, unrestricted, unsupervised, just... Yeah, cleaning lady, come in whenever you want. The monster's basically loose. Like, just come on in. That I was like, this is I'm willing to let things go, but this is too much. And then also I just found the subplots, the B stories of, like you said, like the Cold War stuff, and Giles's art career. Like, those are a distraction from the main plot, and it takes away time from Eliza and the monster getting to spend time together to the point where it maybe could have actually, like, kind of earned bestiality, which, once again, I don't know if you can do that. But
it's a very ambitious thing to set out.
Yeah.
For.
Yeah.
But ultimately, one of the things that works best for this movie is the actors in the movie. I mean, Sally Hawkins is amazing. Michael Shannon has Michael Shannon ever not been amazing? And then you get people like Richard Jenkins and Octavia Spencer, who
she is hilarious in this movie.
She's fantastic. Like, I'm just, I'll go see anything with Octavia. She is borderline honorable mensch. She's fantastic. She's really Michael good. Stuhlbarg, who is just fantastic as the Russian spy, and
he's had a heck of a year.
Yes, he has. He's killing it. Unfortunately, the one thing that didn't work for me was Doug Jones, who normally is amazing playing the Amphibian Man, a character which he has borderline played before in Hellboy when he played the amphibious character.
Did he play that guy?
Yes.
Abe Sapien?
Abe Sapien. That's it.
I joked around when this came out. I was like, this is the origin story of Abe Sapien.
No, he plays Abe Sapien in those films.
Wow. Did you think the monster looked okay? Like, I thought it was just, like, fine. Like, in terms of Guillermo del Toro, a little disappointed.
Yeah, there was nothing about it that was, like,
it just looked
blowing
like
me away. Yeah. Which is why I thought that it was partially an Abe Sapien film. Yeah. Or it looked like the creature from the Black Lagoon. Like, there was nothing about it. And that's one of the things that Del Toro does best is look at Pacific Rim. He invents, and I get that a lot of it is the production design and the team behind that as well, but these characters in his films are amazing. These monsters.
Mostly Del Toro on these, like, in these things, he's the guy. Like, Del Toro is the one coming up with the monster designs.
Yeah. Well, then it just didn't work here. And that's unfortunate. It's just, I feel like this movie has very high highs and very low lows. And
it has
ultimately
bestiality.
And bestiality. That's going to be Jake's, like, whenever this film gets brought up, Jake's going to be like, and that film has bestiality.
I understand that this film is like water as representing love. And they even like comment on like, we're made in the image of the Lord. But, like, the Lord is love, and water can take any shape, so love can take any shape. Like, I'm able to make those connections in my head, but it's still a fish monster. Like, that. This is the level of someone having sex with a chimpanzee. That's what it is. Like, because...
Is it?
Yeah, because chimpanzees can sign language, and they're kind of human.
Yeah.
I'm leaving that silence in right there, by the way.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, it's it was weird. What'd you think of the ending?
It was predictable. I was kind of like, kind of saw that coming. Like, cause it's not like you, Del Toro films for the most part have a somewhat happy ending. It sometimes is very bitter happy, but it's normally a happy ending. And so once I realized like the amphibian man could heal himself from pretty much anything, I was like, and heal other people. I was like, okay, so he has to go back to the water and then she's going to go with him. And the cuts on her neck, I always kind of was like, I wonder if those are gills. Like if, cause here's my, like my thought was like, she was found by a river as a kid. And so my thought was she is the human form of what he is, because where I thought they were going was they say like he has two different ways of breathing and can breathe out of water and in water. And so my thought was like, okay, if he's out of water, then as he's like shedding in the film, that's him losing that monster disguise and becoming human. Like he is somebody who, when he's in the water, looks like that. When he's out of it for a long period of time, becomes human. And that they, him and her, were these like humanoid water creatures that could go like amphibiously between water and land. And so I kind of thought that, but it was in a different way.
That could have been interesting.
And like that, I think Pan's Labyrinth also kind of plays into that, in that the little girl was always meant to be, she was always this princess, and then she, at the end of the film, returns to being that princess. And I kind of thought that Sally Hawkins was that way. Like, she is, like, the princess that was always meant to return.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's... That was the other weird thing, was, like, in the film, and I'm curious if I just misheard this part, but they say that he has two ways of breathing. Like, he can breathe out of water and in water.
Yeah, but I think it's, like, a temporary thing.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like they should have made a... I don't know. Like, it just... The rules of the universe didn't feel clear. I don't... It just was a film that ultimately didn't work for me. And I hate that, because I love Del Toro, and I feel like original films like this should always be celebrated, but it's a film that I was just kind of like, okay, well, there was 2 hours on a Sunday.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Let's get to the question that I think everybody's asking. Is Del Toro an honorable mensch?
You know,
I believe he was originally nominated by Trevor.
He was, and I episode, put the pending on it.
Episode 28.
And I was put our the
Murder on the Orient Express.
Based Jake on put this the pending. Film.
Yes.
And you know, he's not.
Okay, because I had said that he was before this film, and I am with you now in saying that he's not.
He's not a mensch. Sorry, Guillermo. I like your stuff, man, but I just don't know. Like, my grade for this is a B minus. And honestly, I'll be quite disappointed if this wins Best Picture or Best Director at the Oscars, considering all of the other films this year that have come out that have addressed a lot of these same topics. So yeah, B minus. He's not a mensch. I still think that, I mean, clearly this film is working for people. Like, if you have any interest in seeing this, go see it yourself and make your own opinions. But it just was not, it was not there for me.
Yeah. And I think that's where I land as well, is that I was gonna, I'll say it. Guillermo del Toro is almost, he is getting close to a more artistic, he's a more artistic Zack Snyder.
Whoa.
In that his films always look great. Oh, okay, never mind. Can you please cut that? Because that's bad.
No, I mean, I think there's something there. He's better than Zack Snyder.
No. I 100% think that he's... Like, if you asked me, locked me into a room and said, you have two blind movies, which one would you rather watch? Guillermo del Toro, 10 times out of 10. But ultimately, his movies are, and I think what I mean by that statement is that his stories are lacking the depth that I want in them. And that's something that Snyder often struggles with, is depth in his stories, or just a story in general.
Yeah.
And so that's, I feel like that's a very outlandish and shocking, I didn't mean for it to come out that way, but it's a film that, or it's a statement that I more of mean of, like, he's getting dangerous, and not that he cares about my opinion, but he's getting dangerously close to this place where I feel like he's, and I'm sure a bunch of people would argue with me on this point, I feel like he's losing what made him the director that he is today.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So, and I say all of this as somebody who loves Guillermo del Toro. Like I said earlier, I'd give him $100 million every year, because more times than not, he's going to deliver something that's a masterpiece. And that's just, if it's not a masterpiece, it's at least very visually stunning, and it's at least fun to watch. But ultimately, I just didn't get to that place in this movie. I don't understand the awards buzz for it. I think, like Jake said, there's a lot of films that does what this film does better, and there's a lot of movies that deserve the awards that this film might win more than this film deserves them. Ultimately, I think my rating for this film is a C. It's fine, but it's, I don't understand it. I don't understand the buzz. I understand the movie. I don't understand the critical acclaim around it. Our review.
It has bestiality.
So, Jake, what was the number one bestiality moment of the year for you?
I mean, there was only one, and it wasn't good. So,
that's all we have for our review of Shape of Water. Let's go ahead and get into our content of the week that we are recommending for you.
Yeah. So, my content of the week, two pieces, which are different than kind of what I usually recommend. First one is a new Netflix series. I believe it's once a month. It is the new David Letterman show. He's back. One of the best hosts of late night ever. I think it's called My Next Guest Needs No Introduction. Mm-hmm. And the first episode is basically just an hour long sit down conversation with him and Barack Obama. And you know what? It is just really good. It's just really good conversation, really interesting. They talk about very personal, sensitive stuff, and it's just really well done. It's also really refreshing to remember when America had a president that wasn't an embarrassment to the world. You know, whatever your political beliefs, at least he wasn't an idiot, you know. So that was a nice little glimmer of like, oh, remember that, guys, that was nice. And then my second one is a podcast that I've been telling basically everybody about because I just love it. It's called Good Christian Fun. I grew up in a like crazy Pentecostal Christian world. And as most people know, Christian culture is absolutely garbage. Christians make some of the worst music and film ever. And then they sell it and they make a lot of money on it because the word Jesus is attached to it. And there's just all these little Christianisms, Christianese language that is just really funny. And this podcast just playfully jokes with it. I myself am a Christian. I work for a church, okay? But this stuff, it's just really funny. So I would highly recommend it.
Awesome. Well, I am going to recommend two Guillermo del Toro pieces that I think you should check out instead of this. One of which being the film we've already talked about, Pan's Labyrinth, which is one of the best fairy tale movies I've ever seen. It's also one of the most inventive and creative and unique movies I've ever seen. It's just a thrill to watch beginning to end, and something that I wish more people would see and talk about, because it's a masterpiece. The other one is a TV show that he produced, wrote, created. I don't know what else he did. He did a bunch on it. It's on Netflix. It's called Troll Hunters. It's an animated TV show from DreamWorks. If you like things like How to Train Your Dragon, it's very similar to that, except in the world of trolls. And it's fantastic. It's also the last performance from Anton Yelkin. He had recorded, voice recorded this role before he passed away. And season one came out last year. I believe it was 2016. Might have been early 2017 at some point. And then he actually had recorded most of his audio for season two before he passed away. And so even though he passed away in, I believe, March of 2016, in December 2017, there's still a new performance of his that he's just perfect in. So that's Troll Hunters. It's on Netflix, season one and two. I think there's like 30, 40 episodes on there that are just 20-minute episodes. It's pretty fun and inventive world that we've come to expect from Guillermo del Toro. So that's all we have for tonight. If you've enjoyed listening to us, please go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, or just a rating of what you think we deserve. Leave us a review. Let us know your thoughts on the podcast, and ultimately share us with a friend. Tell people you know, hey, if you're going to see this movie afterwards, check out this podcast. And if you've enjoyed it, that's the best and most meaningful thing for us, is to share this podcast with someone you know and love. If you want to interact with us more, you can go to our website at popcornoptional.com. You can find us on Twitter at popcornoptional or Facebook at popcornoptionalpodcast. My name is Cameron Salina. You can find me online at 321CammyTime. Turbo Trevor couldn't be with us tonight, but you can find him online. Go wish him congratulations on the birth of his new daughter at Turbo Trevor. And Jake, where can we find you online?
Find me my website or on Instagram is jakebrown.tv.
That's all we have for tonight. We'll be back next week with another review before in 2 weeks we get to our top 10 of 2017. So until next week, pop, pop.